Welcome to Frankly Speaking on the TurfNet Radio Network. Here is your host, Dr. Frank Rossi.
Welcome to Frankly Speaking. And, you know, doing this podcast for a number of years now, you get to have the same people on. And you establish not just a one-time conversation, but a long-time conversation, which is exactly the sort of feeling I've always wanted about doing this. Because at least in my mind, I have a particular type of person I'm attracted to. And a lot of that has to do with, I think, maybe taking a contrary view to what most people would think is conventional wisdom. Because I found as a scientist, oftentimes, that's where the best discussions can occur. When you're stretching, I don't like to use really out of the box or out of the envelope. I like just stretching our thinking a little bit. And I never do that more than when I'm with my pal Jim Copenhaver, the president and principal of Palooza Golf, who I know works with another pal of ours, Stuart Lindsay, and lots of partnerships that we've talked about in previous shows with regard to what's going on over at Palooza. So, Jim, welcome back to the show. I'm glad you took the time out. You said you Googled your name, and our last show did pretty good.
It did. It was one of the top five searches on the first page. So when you Google Jim Copenhaver, it's going to bring you back to Frankly Speaking, some of the podcasts, and as Frank mentioned, the fun we've had in the past. And it, as he mentioned, I went from 15 years ago being called the industry contrarian, and recently Jake Heron of the NGCOA had me speak to a bunch of his board members, and he said, we're going to invite provocateurs to the conversation. And so he introduced me as a provocateur. I like that a lot better than industry contrarian.
Well, and I would agree with that. And so let's get right to the conversation, which is about, you know, almost, I would say you function as close to an academic in your area as somebody, anybody I know in the private sector. And you write these, you know, really comprehensive pieces that usually typically ends with "If I Were King," which is just appeals to me at so many levels. But the one in particular you wrote back in November that was comparing the golf business to retail and the restaurant business and the kind of absorption or reductions that those businesses have seen. And as we venture into this topic, Jim, I'll tell you, partly the reason it resonated with me is I have the opportunity now to work in the private sector, consulting with companies and working with salespeople and marketing people. And I can tell you that all the people that are, you know, selling and distributing things into this industry, they'll be the first to tell you that reduction in absorption is going on. If it's not going on in numbers of facilities, it's going on in the amount of dollars that those clubs are spending, and it's making it a more competitive sales environment. And I think sometimes companies overreach when they think what they can make in this business because they see the margins being so favorable. So let's have a good deep business conversation about how all that dovetails into what's happening in golf compared to what we've seen in retail and restaurant. Where do you want to start?
Yeah, let's just start there. The point of that newsletter that I did back in November was looking at this and saying the contraction that we're seeing in supply is a natural phenomenon that happens in cyclical industries. And we are a cyclical industry just like retail and restaurants. And I chose those examples, number one, because they're topical. You can't pick up the journal, you know, any day or any week without seeing a certain retail chain or a restaurant chain that is awakened and realized they're overfaced. And one that I saw about 6 months ago when I wrote that article was saying, if you look at the number of retail square feet in the United States compared to any other developed nation, our ratio of square feet to population or to spending was about 3.5 to 1 of any other developed nation. And as an analyst, as you said, my wife calls me the binary man.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
You're either a zero or a one. And I look at facts like that and I say, you know, are we unique? No, we're not unique. The only challenge is that retail and restaurants have been able to, because of the nature of their business, they've been able to contract a lot more quickly than we have. So I really thought that.
That's right. It's, go ahead. Yeah. So, and so, well, what I wanted to, two things. One is, I want to go back to what you just said, that reduction in retail space, okay? At the same time, I think I printed this out right around Thanksgiving, and over the Christmas break, I sit there and consume a whole bunch of stuff, and I think I was reading about it right about the time when, of course, the busy time of the Christmas season, Amazon and other places were talking about opening retail space, or the big shift. That seemed weird to me, because all the retail jobs are going away and there's no way to stop that. And that's the first part of what I'm thinking, that right after you wrote this, that stuff you were predicting was looking like it was starting to happen, that they might want to get into it, but the job growth is really outside of it. That, you know, so that was, I thought, binary man, that's a pretty good prediction that played true. So the second part is, it's not so easy to pick up 200 acres of land and do something else with it,
yep,
like it is to shut down a McDonald's and put in a legal office.
Exactly. So we have a couple of challenges. When I first started looking at this back in 2005, I thought that we would quickly get to a point where we would take 400 or 500 courses out of inventory net for a couple of years, and we would get back to some semblance of order by 2010. And what I've learned very painfully along with the rest of the industry is taking 200 acres of land out of play. Number one, finding an economically viable buyer. Number two, finding finance. And then number three, navigating the angry homeowners, the local community, blah, 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 the Nature Conservancy, and saying you can't take that space out of play. All of that has conspired to kind of saddle the golf industry with, last year we did about 175 close and 25 open for about a 150 net reduction. And you look at that against 15,000 courses and it's like, crying out loud, it's going to take us a long time to get here. So
yeah, and so you're exactly right. I mean, when I hear you say that, you then take that information in your article and you say, okay, here's how many we're losing. This is how hard it is to do. If you're at this point in your business of, you know, if your business is sort of on the edge and you're waiting for something to give you an indication, it's maybe you're going to get a better price. It seemed to me it was a very cautionary tale for what to do if you didn't feel like you had a solid business. And I don't even know what constitutes a solid business anymore in this business.
Well, a solid business in my mind translates into making money after debt service. So what's happening to quite a few golf courses today is they're making marginal money above debt service and they're losing money after debt service. And what's happened, and again, what surprised me is I really thought that the banks and lending institutions would say, if you can't pay us our debt service, even if you're making money on the line immediately above ours, we don't care. We're going to take it back and we're going to sell it. And what we've seen historically, and I wrote about this in one of my most recent articles, is the banks have been very reluctant to take on golf courses, A, because they don't think they can sell them for fair value, so they don't want to take the loss on their books, and B, because the cost of capital for them has been about next to nothing for the past 8 to 10 years. They've been more creative and willing to do the workout. What's going to get really interesting in 2017 is we've seen one rate hike. We're going to see probably two more. And as that happens, I think the banks are going to be less willing to play financial games and hang on to these struggling golf courses. And somebody's finally going to say, no more. I can't take the cost of capital when I now have to pay for that money.
Well, so that makes perfect sense to me. But on the other hand, it's not like a lot of these golf courses can't be repurposed into some development opportunity. In many ways, they're in areas, particularly if they're closing up in places like Florida, or even in a posh suburb of Chicago or a posh suburb of Long Island. I can't imagine that it's that big of a deal to do something else with that land. My question, the question becomes simple again. What don't you think the rate hikes are going to expedite this number quicker?
Yeah, I think they will, but I've been wrong. So one of the things about a good analyst is he admits when he was wrong. And like I said, I was wrong back in 2005 when I projected where I thought we would be today in supply equilibrium. You know, I missed the mark because I thought that those market forces would just naturally take their course. So I still think that will accelerate the takeout rate here. The other thing we don't know is what we need is we need takeouts. If the banks foreclose on these and start saying, hey, we need to generate money from them, they could find a buyer rather than a takeout, which is acceptable and take their loss, in which case we get a transaction. We don't get a takeout. And unfortunately, a transaction is a double whammy for the industry. It didn't take supply out of the system, and it now is going to allow a new owner with a much lower cost basis to compete in the market.
Huh.
So talk about getting smacked upside the head. You're the guy who owns the golf course, who's running it responsibly. Your irresponsible neighboring golf course who put in this Taj Mahal and forced you to up the quality of your course to compete now transacts for 50 cents on the dollar, which means he now can operate that property economically. If it's an $80 golf course, he can run it like a $40 golf course and make money. Now you got another problem on your hands.
Well, and again, I think about how this trickles into the kinds of budgets and resources the golf course superintendent has, whether it's from labor or the ability to have equipment. And there's all this deferred maintenance on the property itself. If you buy in low and you're buying from a desperate buyer, you have to believe they weren't spending much on infrastructure if it was an older place. And that's the thing I find people don't understand, Jim, is how these things, like every other human-built concoction, require maintenance. And if you defer it, even for a year or two, in some reasonable 5 to 7 year rotation, whether it's sprinkler heads or piping or wash pad stuff or whatever it is, they all have useful lives. I don't know that that guy's getting off so easy buying that property low if it's been left decrepit. And that's also the problem for the guy who might have tried to build the Taj Mahal to keep up. He didn't give the money for the deferred maintenance that the poor superintendent has to deal with. And the guys I deal with have to continue to limp through.
Yeah. I think that's a good point. I think there's going to be a market in superintendents for them to alter their skill set slightly, because I think some number of them in the future are going to be given these turnaround situations. So this guy who bought the course for 50 cents on the dollar, I think most of them, and we do market analysis for a number of these type of people who are exploring these options. Unfortunately, like 25% of them actually proceed with the transaction after we get done running the numbers.
But and telling them no and telling them don't buy it.
We just say, here's what it looks like. If you think you can make this work, then you should buy this property. And most of them look at it and say, I mean, most of this work is you have to increase rounds by 10%. You've got to be able to maintain it for something around where it is currently. And you've got to pray that somebody else goes out of business. But I think that what we see in those buyers is they are factoring in deferred maintenance. So the good part is most of them are saying, I'm going to buy it for 50 cents on the dollar. I'm going to put aside $5 to $15 million, 15 being a really high number, to come in and do catch up on the deferred maintenance. But then they're generally looking for a superintendent who can recover that course, because to your point, there's a lot of work that has to be done to get it back in shape. And that's going to take a unique skill set among the architect, or I'm sorry, the superintendents.
Yeah. And I think that is an important point, especially because the majority of our listeners are going to be golf course superintendents. But it's so funny when I hear you talk and you say, just right off the cuff, like it's no problem at all, you believe there's a whole bunch of people who in this business who are praying for someone else to go out of business.
Yeah. There are so many people we talk to and they say, Jim, if I can just hang on another year or two and three of these competitors would go out of business. And, you know, it reminds me, there was that, movie? There was one about the G.I. Jane and the SEALs. And it was like, you know, everybody's waiting for the other guy to ring the bell to wash out. And they're all in extreme agony and they're just praying. They're saying, somebody please ring that bell and it ain't going to be me. But at some point, you reach the end of your physical limit, and it's like you're the guy ringing the bell.
So what does that look like at the end of the physical limit? Obviously, it's different for every operation. But I'm wondering if you were a golf course superintendent, what would be some of the signs that they would pay attention to in the business? Maybe they're younger guys, or maybe they just haven't been very business savvy over the years. It's a mom and pop or a small, public operation. What are the kinds of signs they would look for beyond beyond just, well, we haven't had new equipment in 12 years, or I can't get a part, or, you know, I can't get this. What are the kinds of signs that these courses that are trying to hang on, treading water, what does it look like for them?
Yeah, what I would say, the thing I would look for, and it depends on what access to the books the superintendent has. What I would look for, though, is if your revenue, you know, is falling 1% and they're asking for a 4% give back in the maintenance budget, that's a warning sign to me that basically says, you know what, the revenue is going down by 1%, but they're losing money at the bottom line because they're asking everybody to give back more than the revenue loss. So, I mean, that would be a dead giveaway.
Yeah, so I mean, that's the easiest way to look at it, and we can actually leave that at that, because we're getting close to where I want to ask you the last question before we make our way to our first break.
Okay.
And that is what you said here, if I were king. You almost seem to say, yeah, I'm always sort of the sort of provocative, saying maybe it's not so good, bad as good as everybody else is saying. But you did sort of indicate we're not really any different than the restaurant or retail business, which means we're going to be in business. There's a collection of us that are well-run that are going to thrive in the golf business. Would you agree that those opportunities are there? And what are the characteristics of those kinds of operations that make them sort of, you know, what do I want to call? I don't want to call them Chipotles. I want to call them ones that are a little more upscale, you know, like a Longhorn Steakhouse that's, you know, been successful in some places where people like a lot of meat. I don't know.
Yeah.
What are the characteristics of those sort of properties that are going to make it?
Yeah, I would use Panera probably as a great example. They're doing very well in this environment, and they're not selling cheap food. They're selling an experience. Starbucks is another, would be a great poster child for that. So let me be clear, and I've said this over and over, the sky is not falling on golf. You know, the people who are out and saying, there was one I read this week that said, oh, you know, golf is dying along with its members, and when the current last 55-year-old breathes his last, golf will be gone. It's like, give me a friggin' break, you know? we're going to be around here a lot longer than that guy is in those predictions. So the sky is not falling on golf, but we are experiencing a change in consumer patterns, and we're going to need to change with it to grow again. Otherwise, my prediction is that we're going to come down to a golfer base somewhere around 20 million, and we'll stabilize there, and then we're going to struggle there until we find the next growth catalyst. But the ones that are being successful are the ones that are adapting to kind of the will of the consumer. And the will of the consumer is, you know, we're looking for shorter experiences. So can you give me less than 18-hole options? They're looking for things that say, I want to bring my technology on the course. You know, let me do that. They're saying, I expect you to bring technology to my customer experience, which is I want to be able to check in online, and I want to be able to skip the front desk and go right to the first tee. I mean, you look at hotels today, and hotels are doing everything in their power to get you not to stop at the front desk. Check in.
Right. I got a digital key. I totally embrace the digital key. I don't want to see anybody. And make sure there's water in the room.
Yep. So unfortunately, the hotels and the people like that are saying, hey, we're moving to this digital experience, and the golf industry, unfortunately, is not keeping pace. It's like, we expect you to park here. We expect you to drag your bags here. We expect you to stop and see us here. We expect you to see a starter at the first tee, blah, blah, blah. The ones that we're finding that are successful are saying, I'm going to start playing with all those elements of the customer experience, and I'm going to try and come in line with the emerging consumer preference and how they live the rest of their life outside of golf.
What a perfect end to this first part of the conversation with Jim Copenhaver. I'm Frank Rossi. This is Frankly Speaking. We'll be right back.
Golf course superintendents, now you can aerate and fill 9 inches to 11 inches deep with minimal surface disruption and cleanup. The Maximus Deep Aeration Instant Fill Service from Dryject injects 1 pound of sand per square foot, 22 tons per acre, and leaves services ready for play again in 1 hour. Best of all, Maximus by Dryject is only half the cost of alternative deep aeration and fill technologies. Visit MaximusAeration.com to locate your nearest Maximus by Dryject service center.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. Frank Rossi here with my friend Jim Copenhaver of Palooza Golf. Jim, we set the stage and a very powerful ending there to that statement that there are ways to be successful in this business, but adaptation to the consumer is first and foremost. So you have to have a nimble operation to capitalize on whatever market you may be operating in. So let's talk about that market and the industry line view these days. It's been espoused in a number of different publications in build up for Golf Day on the Hill in April. Three points that I heard my good friend Steve Mona make recently. Somehow there was data he was citing that rounds played are up. He said that there were $3 billion invested over the last 10 years in about 1,000 golf renovations. But the one that really resonated with me was this last one. Fan interest on TV, they're consuming it. And of course, we know that doesn't always translate to golf. But then he went on to the experience that more and more people are having off of non-green grass golf courses, the Topgolf experience, the simulator experience, the engaging in golf in a different format than they're typically doing. And he was really touting that as one way golf was going to make it into the future. Now, I don't think my colleagues who grow grass for a living are necessarily happy to hear that, unless you can answer this question positively. Does their engagement in those non-green grass opportunities lead to green grass opportunities?
Yeah, you really know how to bait a hook. So let's start with the three points. We'll go from the top down because the last one's the most fun. So he basically says rounds played went up last year. They did. They went up 2%. That was behind 2.5% higher golf playable hours. So what we've said all along is the number to watch in golf is not rounds played, it's utilization. In other words, you have to track the weather patterns. If we got 2.5% up in rounds behind flat weather, that would say we generated demand as an industry, and that's a very healthy sign. What we've pointed out, though, is utilization has basically been flat for the past 5 years. So basically, rounds have followed weather. So that's not a health indicator for our industry. It basically says we're being dragged along by the weather, much like a farmer is, unfortunately. So I don't view that as a health sign for the industry. Huh. The second point about the $3 billion being invested, that is a positive sign. I mean, people are putting money back into golf courses, in a large part, though, because they're just trying to keep these things going longer and longer to extend their bets so they can sell the silly property. Because the ones that aren't making any money, as you and I have talked before, I mean, they're basically sucking the paint off the walls. And the superintendent, unfortunately, is the inheritor of that, saying you got to make this tractor run a little bit longer. You got to find a way to do this, cutting the greens fewer times during the week, blah, blah, blah. So I would look at that investment, and when I worked at Kraft, we called those boxcar numbers. You know, how do you build the biggest number you possibly can? Well, what you do is you stretch it across 10 years. You basically get the biggest number that you can possibly get it. But I look at that, and I say, I don't really view that as a sign of health. It's not a bad indicator. But I will also say a lot of the municipalities that we deal with, those renovations they did 10 years ago right now are the millstone around their neck and the reason that they're not making money after debt service, because they're trying to service the debt of all that investment. So again, I would not call that a healthy sign.
Well, and again, back to your analogy of the farming, how many farmers bought too much big equipment and took too big of a lease to upgrade the milking operation, only to see milk prices plummet or their milk not being bought for having BGH in it or for whatever reason? Again, just like you compared earlier retail and restaurants to golf, this is a perfect example of farming situations where if you do make those investments, man, they better be smart capital investments, because if you're carrying that debt service, that means that much more you got to put on debt service, that you got to make more on your T-sheet just to pay the debt. So let's get to the last more interesting part, which is let's do a little one first. I like watching golf. In fact, with the Masters last week, a couple weeks ago, sitting down with my wife and kid, they even enjoyed watching it in a way they didn't normally, because there was great drama in that particular period of time, like often happens at that tournament. So, you know, that thing tends to deliver almost every year. So let's start with fan interest and translation to the game, and then we'll get to the Topgolf stuff.
Yeah, so if you look at fan interest, I've said all along since 2002, 2003, that there is a loose, underscore the word loose, correlation between fan interest and the health of the game. So I won't deny that if we have exciting people to watch on TV, that does things for us at the green grass. But if you look at the fate and the success, really, of the PGA Tour all the way through the housing meltdown of 2008, Fincham and the Tour did a masterful job of keeping that thing together. Purses didn't go up as fast as they had previously, but they never went backwards. So I look at that and I say, in the time that the industry was suffering the most, the PGA Tour and those properties were still growing. So as an analyst, again, I look at that and I say, if we want to make a correlation between the health of the PGA Tour and the media side in our industry, it has to hold up in good times and bad. And what happened was the two things just completely diverged there between like 2008 and 2014. So.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I remember those days. That's when, remember tournaments were named after banks, and all of a sudden those tournament names were changed because the banks didn't want their name associated. I think it was the Wachovia one. Yep. One year they called it the Quail Hollow Open or something.
Yeah, and the optics just became toxic. But what Fincham and the guys did, which was great, is they shifted from automotive and banks into emerging at .coms, the web.com tour, et cetera. So what they were able to do is pivot on the sponsorship. The other thing was he invented the FedEx Cup. This was about the time that they were coming up for renewal with the networks, and the things did not look good. And so Fincham basically said, I'm going to build a NASCAR-like thing at the end of the year, and that's the reason that you should give me a bigger contract for the networks, and they bought it. And the FedEx Cup has been neutral in my mind. It's brought a little bit of interest and excitement. It's nowhere near what it was supposed to be. And it preserved him through those 4 or 5 years until the economy recovered. So I tip my hat to Fincham and the guys. I mean, they've done a masterful job of navigating that. But unfortunately, their success doesn't translate to our success.
That's right. And I will say that For core golfing fans, even like myself that doesn't get a lot of time to play but enjoy watching for a variety of reasons, having a little bit of drama on some really nice courses towards the end of the year does sort of give me that transition to the World Series and football, right? I sort of like just a little bit of golf at the very end of the year when I've got my Yanks in a playoff game and the Packers starting to play in Wisconsin. So, you know, there's some of that I like. But again, translating to the game, I'm not sure is exactly what it's doing. But I'm pleased to hear you give Tim and that crew kudos, because they did it deftly. They Dean and DeLuca, it's some grocery store that's sponsoring an event. So it's just great that they've done that. So let's get to the last interesting part of this, and that is the engagement in the non-green grass activities, Jim. What do you think is, how's that good? Let's start out with, what do we mean? Let's start out, make sure everybody understands, what do we mean by these things?
Yeah, so basically what people are pointing to, and I love the World Golf Foundation and Steve Mona's kind of diversionary tactics. It's like, if you don't like the measures you have, change the measures. You know, if you don't like the storyline, change the measures. So because we're not being successful in growing the golfer base, rounds played, number of facilities, it's like, well, wait, look over here. And the new look over here is virtual golf. So it's people who are experiencing golf not through green grass. And to your point, myself, yourself, the guys and gals who make their living growing turf and managing golf courses, virtual golf does virtually nothing for us.
Well, how about virtual golf does really nothing?
Right. So, and you asked the absolute right question here, which is, the top golf guys have said for years, you know, we're in the business of growing golfers. You know, we provide an entertainment experience, and that's what we're really good at. But we're in the business of growing golfers. And, oh, by the way, we had this partnership with Callaway. And so we are the trial program for Callaway and clubs, so that people who come here, when they go out on a green grass, are going to think about Callaway clubs. We've asked on multiple occasions, and we've talked to some of the people at Callaway over the years and said, can anybody give us any metrics on visitors to Topgolf, on people who have bought Callaway clubs, who first experienced them at Topgolf, who have then bought clubs? Ostensibly, you know, you wouldn't buy a set of Callaway clubs to go back to Topgolf. You would be going on a golf course. And both of them have multiple times politely declined to provide any information about conversion rates or trial rates or any of those success metrics. So I look, and as an analyst, I listen to people all day long, and yet you take it back to, until somebody can produce a number or some sort of hard concrete evidence that Topgolf produces people who want to go out and play on a green grass facility, in my mind, it's just, it's Dave and Buster's around golf. And I'm not unhappy about it. Anything that happens that's around golf at least gives us some air cover and you know, some awareness of the sport. But we're deceiving ourselves with this narrative that says if Topgolf grows to the sky and has 500 facilities next year, that's going to breed 500,000 golfers, because nobody has produced any evidence, any concrete evidence that that in fact is happening now, let alone that it would expand along with Topgolf.
And you have to believe if it was occurring, that conversion was occurring. Now, it could be too early, right? I mean, I'm not familiar with the health of the Topgolf model in particular. I have been to one in Texas. I have been to one in Chicago. And both of them were similar experiences. I would say that, you know, it sort of turns golf into a pinball game or into bowling of some sort. And to be honest, it's not clear to me how that translates with the way they decided to keep points. It doesn't even resemble a golf course when you're hitting out to it, I think, in some ways. So listen, Jim, I want to take another break, because when I come back, I would rather talk about the ways real golf courses could be nimble and adapt, and not just technology on checking people in and out, but technology and reimagining what the golf course should be when you're on it. When we come back with Jim Copenhaver on Frankly Speaking, we'll continue the conversation.
Golf course superintendents all agree. Traditional core aeration is time-consuming, labor-intensive, and unpopular with golfers. Dryject is a revolutionary service that relieves compaction, increases water infiltration, improves gas exchange, and amends your root zone all at the same time, leaving the turf surface smooth and immediately playable. Best of all, an independent Dryject service professional does it for you, there and gone before you know it. Dryject, the only process in the world that aerates, top dresses, and amends in one pass. Visit dryject.com to locate your nearest Dryject service center.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. Frank Rossi here with Jim Copenhaver from Palooza Golf. Jim, when we left, I think, as we've seen, maybe virtual golf alone isn't going to convert people. So here's the question. If, as you said, there's some adaptation you would suggest the golf industry could make, there seems to be, that's point one. Point two is there appears to be this virtual experience that appeals to some people, okay? That's, we've never sort of had that before. So what happens if we did both? What if we took and challenged our PGA professionals? And we're working with superintendents. I don't know how that would work, but if the PGA professional then would say, okay, let's bring some version of a Topgolf to the club or to my place, so that you didn't go to Topgolf in town, you came to the simulator at my club, and hey, you see the regular guys. It's just what we do in the wintertime. We have, one day a week golf leagues just in simulators, or that the technology pros are using to develop a swing or help people get involved, or having three-hole golf courses where a guy can play a par three, a par four, and a par five. Certainly people have an hour and a half to play some golf. If there were more green grass practice facilities that was a hybrid between the virtual experience and the full-blown 9 or 18 holes, are we doing it? If not, why not? And if we are, is it working?
Yep. So let's start with, what's the attraction to Topgolf? And that's what we're trying to bottle. The attraction to Topgolf is fun. I mean, when you go there, your primary thing is, I'm going to have fun for 2 hours.
And so, because, you know, when you go on a golf course, half of it's torture.
Exactly. More than half of it. For the average golfer, more than half of it is. So the first part is kind of the fun of it. And my sense is, and that starts at the check-in and when you step up to the first tee, and something that I proposed to those NGCOA board members when I went out there is, if you look at what greets you at the first hole of most golf courses, it's the 15 course rules. And it's don't even think about this. And you go to Topgolf and you step into your bay and you've been there, I've been there as well. You see any signs at Topgolf that says, don't? No. I mean, the rules at Topgolf are don't injure yourself and don't send anything downrange that isn't a golf ball. So the first thing I think that we could do, that we could strive to import, is fun. And the speech that I gave to the board members was, I said, we ought to be about guidelines, not about rules. Forget the USGA rules. 90% of the people who go out and play could give a rip less about the USGA rules. You know, if you're stymied behind a tree, move the stupid ball. If you've attempted two outs from a sand trap, pick it up and toss it out into the green. You know, par is whatever you want it to be. To leave the scorecard behind. Just go out and hit the ball down the fairway and be happy when you hit a shot that's close to the hole and something goes in. So what I suggested to them is, I said, we could make the courses a lot more fun by abandoning a lot of the trappings. And I posted 10 guidelines that I would use. And the first one was like, have fun. The second one was, you know, advance the ball by any means that makes you happy. The third one was, you know, have respect, play at pace, you know, have respect for the people around you. So as I look at it, I think we could set a more fun atmosphere for them. The other thing that I think we could do as an industry, which is out of the control of the golf courses and the superintendents, is I would like to see recreational equipment. And I'm one of the heretics in the industry that are saying, you know, my son told me, he went out and played last weekend. He's not a very good golfer. And his biggest thing is he can't get the ball up in the air. So he said, slugging around this course, it's a local course and it's fairly long. He said, I just slogged through it because, you know, I can only advance it 50 to 75 yards in the air on any given hole. And I'm looking at him going, with all the technology available today, we can build golf clubs that would allow somebody to get the ball airborne. I'm not saying that we abandon traditional golf. What I'm saying is, let's allow recreational equipment as an on-ramp that allows people to get the ball airborne and hit the ball straighter during their initial experience. Some number of those people will stay in recreational golf. I'll bet you, though, that some number of those people will get the bug and say, hey, this is really fun. I'd now like to take it to the next level, in which case you say, we now introduce rules, we introduce scorecards, and we introduce conforming equipment.
That's exactly right. And I'll tell you, you know, as a lifelong lover of baseball, right, baseball is the sport that's always mattered to me. Yep. Played it as a kid and played it into college, enjoyed it. Later on, I played some fast pitch softball, but eventually I stopped playing, but I played a fair amount of slow pitch, you know, the arc slow pitch softball, right? I would liken that in many ways to how you've kept people playing baseball and softball leagues and those sorts of things, just like you're doing, like you could do if you made a game that is so miserably hard. I had a conversation recently with Brian Whitlark. He's a USGA agronomist in the southwestern part of the United States, and he did a study looking at firmness of greens and abilities of the ball to hold on the green. And he tested hundreds of greens for their different parameters, and then simulated shots with an engineer at the USGA, how the ball came into the surface and how things mattered. Yep. And to be honest, unless you made that thing a sand pit, okay, 99% of the time, people with slow club speed, right, older people who can't get the club around, if they're in the rough, are going to hit the ball relatively fast at a very sharp angle.
Yep, low trajectory.
Low trajectory, and no matter, unless you put bumper, you know, the equivalent of bumper bowling, Jim, you know, this is a hard game. And I don't, you always say this, and I hear you say it five different ways, but there's a part of you that must think the traditionalism of this game, while we revel in it, may be our demise.
It's only appealing to a certain portion of the population. It's a growth inhibitor. So I look at it and I say, we got almost to 30 million participants with the current product, and we're now down to 22 by our count. So my sense is, we were able to take our current product in a different day and age and push it to almost 30 million people in the United States. Now what's happened is consumer sentiment has changed. And as consumer sentiment has changed, people are not willing to beat themselves up for 4.5 hours over something that they're not going to be very good at. We've retreated back to the people, the traditionalists, who say, I'm either just that stubborn or I actually enjoy it. And I get the fact that I'm going to shoot 100, you know, like I do quite often, but I enjoy the 5 or 6 good shots. So I look at that and I say, it is the inhibitor to our growth. Unless we believe that consumer sentiment is going to go back to the 1990s, we're at 21 and we ain't getting back to 30 unless we change something in this product and the way that we're, you know, positioning it to the consumer.
Right. Well, and that's right. And then there's always the argument that we should have never been at 30 because a lot of that was, you know, measures of things that we couldn't sustain anyway.
That's a two-edged sword. I love the NGF went on record and said, you know, don't worry about it. The people we're losing were not really golfers. It's like, come on, anybody who picked up a golf club, got to a golf course, they had to have spent some money on equipment and went out there even once. It's like, this is not tennis, you know. So I look at that.
That's right.
I say those people picked us up for some reason. I think what they meant to say was that we never got them to the involvement that made them stick. And what I'm proposing is our current product is not going to get those people to come back and enjoy it to a level it's going to stick. It's just not going to happen.
Okay, so we're wrapping up here, Jim, and I got this particular question for you now that you've set me up for it, and I'm sure you've set me up for something I'm going to walk into just like a dope. For many, many years, you would look at the first tee or getting more youth or getting more women into golf and say, you know, we're distracting ourselves trying to grow the game over there when we should be catering to our core.
Yep.
And so now you're suggesting the consumer sentiment is something we can actually adjust to that you feel comfortable with minor changes and still cater to our core. Because, like you just said, there is a collection of people who that traditional thing that you just characterized as a growth inhibitor. Do we aggravate those people? Is this a double-edged sword if we try to alter the game in this way by literally, essentially creating two sets of rules, right?
Yeah. So, and that's a loaded question. I'm going to be very political on this one. So as I look at it, what I've said all along is golf appeals primarily to older white males that have money. And what I've said is we can go get juniors and women, but I'm looking at it, I'm saying we've got like 70 million older white males with money who have not tried our sport. So the first place that I would go fishing for people is when you walk out on a golf course, and I know this is politically incorrect, but I'm going to say it. You look around, and if the rest of the people there kind of look like you, you feel at home. If you're the only woman on the golf course and you look around, it's a bunch of guys out there, it's just not that attractive an experience. That's not saying that we shouldn't be attempting to attract females, but it's basically saying that's just natural selection. So I've maintained for a long time that what we ought to be doing, the lowest hanging fruit, is cloning our existing consumer. And there's a bunch of them out there that don't play our game. I think that even with recreational equipment, the people who are most likely to take it up are still going to be people who look more like our current consumer base than the antithesis of our consumer base. You know, I look at the barriers for women, and the barriers for women, if you look at any of the surveys, are they're expecting a different experience. The women don't talk so much about the game being so difficult. They talk about it's a social experience. I'm not trying to test my mettle. I don't see it as a test of my character out there like the guys do. I like to get together with my female friends, and it's 4 hours well spent. Mm-hmm. And they say, you know, I like certain aspects of the game. I like the exercise. You know, few of the guys like the exercise, but the women, it's one of the top three things they say. It's a thing that I can do and go out and walk and get exercise.
That's exactly right. So looking at it demographically, you're saying that in some ways, the way we've tried to grow the game in the past was more expanding the demographics rather than drilling deeper or taking more of the demographics we are likely to capture. Certainly that many of the models you use, even in Pellucid, probably assume, right?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, cloning models are standard in any other business. Retailers, they look at their best customers and they say, what are the demographic characteristics of my best customers? And they go hunt, they buy acquisition lists based on the demographic characteristics of their best customers. Everybody else in the world does this, except us.
Okay. Well, Jim, you and I have concluded another wonderful conversation here on Frankly Speaking. Thanks for taking the time to chat with me. I hope you enjoyed it.
I did. It's always a pleasure. And I enjoy our time both on air and off air. And I love the work that you do. And I'm looking forward to some of the agronomy standardization stuff that you're going to attempt to bring to the industry. I think that'll be exciting and appeal to analytics folks like me.
Well, thanks very much. And it brings our pal Stuart Lindsay back into the conversation, who you know, just his curmudgeon attitude just warms my heart every time I'm around. Stuart, Jim, thanks for joining me. I'm Frank Rossi. This is Frankly Speaking, smart talk from leading thinkers.
You have been listening to Frankly Speaking with host Dr. Frank Rossi on TurfNet Radio Network. Check back for schedules on future programs. Thanks for tuning in.